At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Our press secretary gave alternative facts to that.
My goal in this deposition was to be truthful, but not particularly helpful.
Welcome to Unspun, the podcast that makes you better at finding the truth. The way people get news is changing. It used to be that there were many reporters who would research stories and write articles, but now politicians and famous people share information directly with you on social media and the internet. That means you find out things fast, but it's up to you to make sure the information's actually accurate. And newsmakers don't always do their part. The temptation to manipulate information is strong. They bend the truth to deceive so that they can avoid accountability, so that they can advance their agendas. When you recognize these agendas, you can sometimes find out what's real. And we're at a crossroads where anyone can share anything online, so it's important to sharpen your critical thinking skills. Finding that deception before it goes viral is pretty much a survival skill now, and we're going to do it together. Let's get unspun. Hi, everybody, and welcome to Unspun for this week. As you probably know, I work at a university, and universities have really been in the news lately. One of the big tensions that you have with universities is the fact that they are large and complicated organizations. They have a lot of stakeholders, but you can't exactly run a university like a business. Author David Rozowski, writing in Forbes, gives some reasons why universities are like businesses. They collect payments, they deliver services, they have employees, they compete with each other. And you know, in a lot of ways, that does sound like a business. But if you ask most college faculty, they strongly believe that treating a university like a business is the wrong way to go. And that's for a few reasons that we professors think are pretty important. One of the biggest of those is academic freedom. Academic freedom means that professors have the opportunity to study the things that they believe are important. You'll sometimes see news programs making fun of this. They'll talk about why would you want to have a shrimp run on a treadmill? Or why would you want to study the lyrics of Taylor Swift as if they're modern literature? It can be easy to pick on small examples, but generally speaking, the time frame of some of the things that we study in the academy is really different from the time frame of an organization that needs to make profit for shareholders today, like a business does. If you apply those pressures to faculty, you may never get the answers to important questions. Here's an example. One of the major issues in the recent COVID-19 pandemic has been the issue of communicating to people about their health in a way that they can understand and that will motivate them to act to protect themselves and other people. When I look at it as a communications professor, I know that we use some of our understanding from research conducted in the entire 2000s to help with this. But if universities were a business, they would have to do the things that were the most immediately profitable. So you can imagine if you were studying back in 2016, when a global pandemic was not at all on most people's horizon, it would be really hard to get a lot of excitement about studying something that's not happening right now. There's just no immediate return on that investment. And so it is with a lot of different fields of study. I remember going to a birthday party with my kid when she was little and hearing another parent talking about how broad education is useless. In my mind, what you need to do is go down the street to XYZ company and ask them what their employees need to know, and that's what you need to teach in college, that guy said. And you know, that might be okay for a new graduate going into a first job, but I think a lot of faculty like me would hope that the education you get in college is going to prepare you for every job for your entire life, not just that first one. To run a university like a business would be maximizing short-term returns and not looking at those bigger picture questions that could really be very important to society later. So comparing a university to a business is in some ways a false comparison. And we'll talk about those false analogies in this week's warm-up. A false analogy happens when someone compares two things that are not actually similar enough to be compared. And this can lead to some really bad conclusions. The comparisons can even seem really convincing on the surface, but when you take a closer look, the similarities just aren't there and the argument falls apart. Here's an example.
People of Pennsylvania have their voices heard and their votes counted. Now, Senator Obama says he's getting tired of the campaign. His supporters say they want it to end. Well, could you imagine if Rocky Balboa had gotten halfway up those art museum stairs and said, well, I guess that's about far enough. That's not the way it works. Let me tell you something. When it comes to finishing the fight, Rocky and I have a lot in common. I never quit. I never get up. And I know that we're going to make it together, not just up those stairs.
This is Hillary Clinton back when she was running for the Democratic nomination against Barack Obama. And she's comparing herself to Rocky, the cultural icon for overcoming and hard work. She's talking to a labor union in Philadelphia, which is where the movie Rocky is set. I have to tell you, comedians got a lot of mileage out of this quote. And as a proud Gen Xer who saw Rocky as a child, an important aspect of that first movie was that Rocky worked hard, but he lost. The analogy falls apart when you look below the surface, because I don't think Clinton was saying, I'm going to work really hard and then lose. COVID was full of opportunities for false analogies, too. People try to explain things that they just really didn't understand very well. So, for example, bleach is a good disinfectant, and if you put bleach solution on a contaminated area, it can't kill pathogens there. But then maybe your president starts saying things like this.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like golf by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number of the lungs. So it'll be interesting to check that. So that you're going to have to use medical doctors with. But it sounds interesting to me.
Wiping a contaminated countertop with disinfectant is very different from wiping the inside of my lungs with disinfectant. That analogy just doesn't work. Now, I do want to be fair, and a lot of people have not been very fair about this comment. The former president did not tell anyone to drink bleach, although, as a candidate, Joe Biden has accused Trump of doing that, a fact that PolitiFact had to go in and debunk. But I can also say that 4 states reported a surge in calls to their poison controls hotline about hazardous disinfectant exposure after he said that, according to an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Here's one more example.
People are very proud to show up and go to the polls. They really are. I mean, they wait in line at Georgetown Cupcake for an hour to get a cupcake. So I think they can probably wait in line to do something as consequential and critical and constitutionally significant as cast their ballot.
That was former President Trump's advisor Kellyanne Conway talking about calls to have more mail-in voting due to the COVID-19 pandemic. She compares voting to waiting in line for a cupcake, which she correctly notes most people do willingly. So where does the analogy fall apart? Getting a special cupcake is a luxury. The people that you're going to see standing in line for a luxury are people who have the free time to spend an hour and have $4 for a treat and who choose to spend their time there. People standing in line to vote are doing something different. They're exercising their constitutional right and, you could argue, meeting their obligations as citizens in a democracy. The analogy falls apart because the type of act that two people are doing is not very similar at all. False analogies get used a lot. Sometimes it's an innocent mistake. It's somebody thinking aloud or saying something before they've thought it all the way through. Sometimes it's an intention to be deceptive or to diminish someone else's experience. But when you look under the surface, those false analogies just don't hold up.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
I need to take a quick break. When I come back, we'll have my uninterrupted interview with 2 very smart and funny women who go by the name Frangela as they appear on stage, on television, and on the Final Word podcast right here on the MSW Media Network. I'll be right back.
All right, so they're both lovely and amazing. And Angela V. Shelton and Frances Callier, welcome to Unspun.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you.
You guys have had a lengthy and storied career at this point, and I'm wondering if your messaging has changed over time, and if so, like maybe how it's changed or why it's changed.
I think it's deepened. you know, we're from Second City in Chicago. And so, you know, we've always been social, political, cultural, trend people, right? Our entire careers. And even after we had a local radio show here in Los Angeles, I would say post-Obama, we have had to deepen our relationship with politics. And because it went from an observant place and space to really, I would say, a personal space.
Super interesting. I watched the video of the interview you did with Netflix as a joke. And one of the things that was so interesting to me, I guess in a way it's obvious, but I hadn't realized it. So, you know, blinding flash of the obvious for that. But was when you were talking about how when you do improv, you have to be completely aware of everything going on in the world because your audience could ask you about anything going on in the world, right? But I am wondering how much your improv experience affects the way that you do like podcasting and stuff.
Oh, it's how we perform. You know, we definitely are all about listening, yes anding, all that stuff comes into play when we're doing anything. You know, it's just, it infects you. It becomes your way of doing things. But I think that in general, you know, we have an actual interest in these things, you know? And so we're not people who have like a couple of hobbies. We're interested in a bunch of things. And I'm not saying that we're an expert on them, you know, but we have an interest in it and we will indulge that interest. And we are people who look up things when we don't know what they are. But we also don't lie about what we don't know, you know? So like, if we don't know something, we don't know it. And we will try to figure it out. But so when we're, I would say that one of the first rules in my mind, one of the most important rules of improv is respect for your audience. And I think that that informs everything we do. That we do our audience, we respect them, we respect their intelligence, we expect their sincerity, and they deserve those things from us too.
Because, you know, it's one of the things, like when we do stand up, why people I think feel comfortable speaking to us is because there is a relationship between us and the audience, and the audience knows it.
It feels like a conversation more than you know, some rehearsed product.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. At the start of your podcast, you start off by thanking patrons, as one does, and noting that you're a Black woman-owned podcast. And so I have my own ideas about why that's an important voice, but I would love to hear yours. Do you think that your perspective affects kind of the world of news commentary?
I hope so. I would love it to. That is the goal. And yeah, I think it's a really important thing to say because I think that a lot of people, we have a lot of different people come to us in one platform from a lot of different areas, you know? And I think that oftentimes we don't give our own selves the right to say, oh yeah, I am doing that, the acknowledgement, that's the word I want to say. We don't acknowledge the choices that we make. Sometimes even for the people who are our friends, who are supporting us through our podcast, they may not realize that, hey, who are white, who are going, hey, you know what you're doing? You are supporting a Black woman-owned business.
Yep.
Pat yourself on the back. You are part of this reality that helps me keep food on my table. You know, and if you, you know, if you were looking for a place to land your contributions each month, let me let you know that they are well received here.
Yeah.
And you can see what we do with it.
Yeah, it goes into the right places, you know, and I, you know, for me, I, you know, I've just become more and more aware of how obviously who you are is who you are. And so I rarely sit down and say to myself as a Black woman in my own head, you know, but the reality is, oh, you know, I'm always struck by that our experience is our experience. And so when we get often, you know, we have a podcast Idiot of the Week, and we'll get, you know, stories from people send us. We don't look them up at all. They're all sent to us by people, listeners. And they, you know, we'll get a stupid story, and it won't be about theoretically about race. But like, we did a story just recently about a group of teenagers who were cutting down street signs, and they got arrested because it was a felony, you know, and the driver did. And, you know, they were showing in the articles they often do now, different social media posts, and people sort of, it seemed like a lot of people saying, hey, these are kids being kids, let them go. And I was like, well, I know they're white. Like,
yeah.
because if they were a bunch of black kids, it would be gang activity. They'd be thugs and they'd be throwing the book at them.
Yeah.
You know, and there wouldn't be a public outcry about, is this too harsh? And we say that. You know, yeah. We don't mute that part of our opinion. We said that there. We're like, well, we know now that who these people are and where we, you know, because that is why this is the world I live in is fundamentally different, even though it's the same space, you know. And so then a lot of my friends and family, you know, even their experience. So, you know, I think that when people support us, I am keenly aware that there aren't that many of us in a lot of these spaces. And that they have, you know, they say that the average podcast listener only listens to podcasts like maybe something like, I want to say it's under 5 hours a week. And like, so if you choose to use some of those minutes for us, we're honored by that.
Really? Truly.
You know, that's amazing. Because you have a lot of places to go. Because we all know everybody going to listen to the NPR one and Rachel when she got a new one. And then, you know, there's some people that are just big and they're just going to get. So when you get any of those minutes, as you know, as a podcaster, it's like trying to get those minutes. It's just we really want to show up for the people who show up for us.
You know what you mean about that? Like, I think about sometimes someone like sitting on the subway in New York and like my voice is in their ears. And that's just mind blowing.
Isn't it? It's totally crazy.
I can imagine that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
We were on a plane once coming back from a gig, and we had the worst seats. We were like in the last row of the plane in like middle seats, one in front of each other. And you could see on literally hundreds of the little TVs in people's seats, they were showing us on, it was, I think it was the Mission Impossible special we did on, was that Dateline?
Yeah, it was NBC. Yeah.
We were, so... We're there, and you start to see people like next to us in the row, like look over and be like, "That's her? Is that her in the seat?" And I was like, "There should be a rule that if you are currently on a TV, you get to go to first class. This is like not fair." But like, yeah, like it's funny when you think about it, you don't realize how many people are maybe seeing you, and then one you'll have an experience like that, and you're like, "Oh,
oh, that's such a great story." But I tell you, one thing that I notice is that, you know, as you said, you're one of a small number of people who are bringing a unique and important perspective, but it also feels like you're bootstrapping it, right? Mm-hmm. That like, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, I'm a tiny little podcaster. I've made 12 episodes so far, and it is very hard. And you've done more than 500, and you have to raise all your own support.
Yeah.
So first of all, kudos to you for that. But second of all, what do you think that says about the way that kind of society values the message that you have?
Well, you know, Angela has said it over and over and over again. If we were white men, we would have made it by now. You know, if we were white guys. And the reality is that we are blessed to have the support that we have.
But yes.
The reality is as well, there are so few liberal spots and spots for Black women. And, you know, and here's the other part about being Black women. We have one podcast, you know, two different podcasts, but, you know, if we go into a space to try to sell them, people don't know where to put you, you know? Is this, because we're not giving girlfriend advice, or talking about romance and relationships. So they can't ghettoize us into those spaces. And so I also say that this is a Black woman on podcast because we we are in these very different spaces, especially for Black women. You know, we are in the college boys with our podcast, Idiot of the Week. That's the white boy college yuck space. And we're two Black women working in that space.
It's so weird though. People get really confused. And I would say it's the thing that I find sort of regularly really frustrating because, you know, we're sitting here, we're doing this podcast, it's a news podcast, and a podcast about stupid stories. And we've had more than one group of people, from networks to TV networks to independent, thoughtful, liberal networks. Then they know what we do. We've been doing it. They love it. They say they love it. It's amazing. They want it, but they don't know where to put it. And I'm like, how about with the other news shows? Like, it's just like suddenly we get confused about how to work this, you know, and what we need to do.
Or what space you belong in.
Exactly. And I feel like at those moments, there's a big part of me that just wants to look at them and say, why don't you respect your audience more than this? Like, you know, because what you're struggling with, but they aren't. You know, like, it's the place where, you know, when you watch people be in spaces that without that, right? Like, when I watch somebody who's an Instagram influencer, and in no way am I denigrating that, but that they have no experience in this arena. They have no training in this arena, but they are on a show like Bill Maher, you know, and not even that they're more popular than us, that they even bring some new, these people are not more popular, you know, in terms of those social media numbers, but a show makes a decision. They make a decision about who they're going to elevate. And the liar in your choice, yeah, the lie of that choice is where you get I'm sure you've experienced it too in every area, you know, where we all get frustrated because when it's somebody else, everybody knows how to compensate, you know, but when it's us, it gets confusing for folks. They're not really sure what to do. And that is hard.
Yeah. Well, see, you know, as long as I've been paying attention, so, you know, at least 30 years, you know, it's been a known issue that news in general suffers from a lack of representation of Black and brown people, both in the topics that they cover and in the journalists who do the coverage. What do you think is the cost to society of that?
Oh, I can tell you the cost of society. So right now, it is the fentanyl crisis that we're having right now, because had we had proper representation when we had a crack epidemic in the 80s and 90s and Black families were torn apart and we all thought that, oh, what we'll do is we'll reduce the amount of drugs that you need to have, but we'll expand the sentences, right? We'll do that. We didn't think about,
treatment
or what this does to families or addicts or anything, or getting people help, right? But had America heard about it, cared about it, been talked about it, right? Had we had an allyship in this country then, I'll give you another example. Had we had an allyship during the AIDS crisis?
Yeah.
Had we had a system put in to be able to help people, we'd be better during COVID.
Yeah, we still don't have representation for people of different abilities, for not neurotypical people, for, you know, the LGBTQIA community. Like, it's, yeah.
So that's why we need these voices. That's why we need your voice. That's why we need those things, because to sit here and say these things are important, and when we bring focus and awareness to them, then we find solutions. So when we find small solutions in the small situation, in the service of others, that's when we can apply those solutions in the larger society. That's how it works.
In your news commentary, I love your intellectual bits that you have in there. Like, I hear them popping up all the time. And so, you know, being a college professor, I'm like, yes, you know, the classes mattered, whatever. So, you know, doing my due diligence for this interview, I noticed that both of you studied liberal arts back in college, and it really shows up in the way that you think about issues and the way that you cover them. And so one of the things that you call out regularly on your show is people's ignorance of history and their failures in logic. Why do you think this shows up in the media so much?
Oh my goodness. It's just so ridiculous these days. I can't. It's because there's no logic. Like, it's just, you know, the sort of the incompleteness of one of the things that gets us all the time is whenever people, this comes up a lot around police violence and the concept of one, a bad apple. And this is a simple thing, but the saying is a bad apple spoils the bunch. And yet the way that it gets applied, it's a simple thing, but the way that it gets applied in the news is the opposite of that. It's the idea, well, there's just one bad apple, we can just get rid of it. It's like, no, that's not how this works. Like, it's like, and you know, the fact that people talk about right now, where the day that we're talking to you, this, you know, Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments in the case to keep Trump off the Colorado ballot. And listening to people talk about amendments to the Constitution that are a direct result of the Civil War, that are directly intended to stop an insurrectionist group of people from being able to stay in power. Like, and have these justices that they're going, well, how does this apply to this? I'm like, are you kidding? Like,
right. Yeah, and to piggyback on what Angela is saying in terms of logic, that's the, I believe, the main reason we do Idiot of the Week is that we got sick and tired of just reading the articles that we were just like, no, we got to break this down. We must.
Because it's an epidemic.
Down. Because if we have a whole state that I am concerned about, and you know what it is, it's Florida. I don't know what's in the water.
You don't know what.
I don't know what y'all drinking, what you're teaching.
I'm wrong.
But we got at the Port St. Lucie, we're coming to get you. We're coming
and
to
I
get
know
you.
People, I'm going to tell you, you're not going to believe me, but you need to look it up. Port St. Lucie is the stupidest place on this planet.
On this planet.
It absolutely is. When I tell you, if there are 10 idiot stories, 1 to 2 of them every week is from Port St. Lucie. It's not that big a city to have that kind of impact.
No.
Something is wrong there. I don't know what it is, but we need to send FEMA. Something's wrong.
Okay.
Get out now if you can think. And you in Port St. Lucie, because I don't know what's going to happen to you.
Run.
One of the things I think about is that, you know, now newsmakers don't have to go through the media to get information to the public, right? You know, any idiot of the week can talk straight into their phone and be live streamed to the whole world. And so that's also the place where most people get their news, which is...
And we're living in Andy Warhol's reality.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, he said his famous saying was, everyone will be famous for 15 minutes. That was his big...
His minutes are long.
I know. But he was saying every single person at some point will have the focus for 15 minutes, you know?
I think people are hoping for it.
Yeah, you combine that with the there is no bad publicity.
Right.
Some unfortunate effect. So you bring up some of those posts, and one of the points that you've made is about false equivalency, right? And so a lot of times people will bring up false equivalency by calling some, because they want to call someone a hypocrite. And, you know, as we've talked about on my podcast before, calling someone else a hypocrite is a bad argument. Like, you can do better. But anyway, I'm wondering your opinion on how this kind of false equivalency is specifically a problem when you have news stories about issues that affect Black and brown people.
Oh, how? Well, you know, if you are not a watcher of Fox News, if you are not, or News Nation, or, you know, a lot of these other, as you were just talking about, sources of news. And those are the clean sources. Those are the ones that have gone through some sort of producer, some sort of POV. We're not even talking about what people are just free ranging out here on TikTok and believing and buying. So with all of that, you know, we still need people to be able to articulate the idea from the inside. We need the inside voices. We need the outside voices. We need different voices that are not centered in Washington. We need different voices that are not necessarily centered in the government. You know, I think that when I am watching a lot of that coverage, I am watching the same question, the same tired question being asked over and over and over again. I never see a new perspective. I never see a new POV. It is always, you know, like, are people going to vote? To me, that's the wrong question.
This is the problem, the way this works, that somehow, somewhere along the line, the idea of fairness got all these concepts got confused with each other. Fairness, equal time, have open perspective. And then just what is reporting the news and what is commentary? Woo. And what is opinion?
Yeah.
And we grew up with the old newscasters, you know, Walter Cronkite, whatever, and this idea that they are there to report, not to influence, not to tell you what they think about it. And we have moved into now even networks that I watch and enjoy, like MSNBC, what MSNBC is all day long is an opinion show.
Yep.
Opinion show after opinion. The false idea that it's some sort of breaking news, it really isn't. There are opinion shows after opinion shows, and you find the one that you like and you watch that. And then if you want new, and now, you know, with Sinclair Media and local media being bought up by these big, you know, corporations, there's, you know, so much of the news has become this. Both sides do it. This is what I mean by false equivalencies, right? So the idea is the way we show that we are unbiased is that if we say something, quote, negative about this side, we have to say something negative about the other side. And those things aren't equal necessarily and don't have many. So, but they're put there like they're equal. So when they talk about, and I watch Andrea Mitchell do this all the time, when they talk about the 91 felony counts against, you know, indictments against, not felony, but indictments against former President Donald Trump, she then will move to, you know, we talk about the documents case and the stolen documents and boxes of documents that he was keeping at Mar-a-Lago and refusing to return. And the documents we know haven't been returned, right? She then goes, well, Biden had documents, as if those things are the same. And as if they are in any way were treated the same. And they weren't. And they're not. And acting like those are the same issues, or because you said that's not fairness, that isn't, and I'm not looking for you to be fair, I'm looking for you to report the news. And if the news that day is Donald Trump committed a bunch of felonies and nobody else did, then that's the news that day. You don't have to go searching for something negative to say and elevate to the same level status of that story in order to seem unbiased. I deeply resent it. And we see the evidence of what this has done in terms of in our educational system. What was it a few years ago? I want to say it was during COVID, but it might have, you know, in 2020, which we're still in COVID, obviously, but I think it might have been in 2020, the survey that showed that's like, what was it, over 70% of high school sophomores couldn't tell an opinion from a fact. It was, and I was like, that is terrifying. These are people who are on the brink of adulthood and voting. And when you hand them information and one of it, that information is factual and some of it is opinion, they can't sort it out.
Well, at my daughter's school, they had to take a year-long class in their sophomore year about data and research and knowing your sources. And, you know,
that's a magnet school.
Yeah.
That's not the school that everybody gets. Yeah.
Yeah. But the reality is that somebody has to teach that.
Yes.
It has to be taught.
When you want to look at a generational difference of technology, one of the things that I would say is that even though a person 30 years younger than me they have this device now, almost all of them in their hand 24 hours a day that can bring them almost any piece of information they want. They're all actually much more likely to be much less culturally literate than somebody in my age and older who doesn't have that phone. Because when we grew up, we only had a few networks and we had to go look up information on with microfiche and other evil devices like that. And they will never know that pain. They will never know the tick, tick, tick of a microfiche machine. But the thing is that we had to, if you wanted to watch TV, you were going to watch old movies. When you think about the fact that there are kids who will never see Titanic, because it's a bad example, but Casablanca or all these films that are pivotal and foundational and that are a lot of our cultural references come from. You know, like, I remember, you know, I brought it up today, Cool Hand Luke, and realizing how many cultural references come from that movie, you know, and that these, because I watched those movies because they were what was on.
We're talking about socialization. There was a point when Americans, when I hear the lamenting from the MAGA crowd of what used to be, what I am hearing a lot of is this lament, lamenting of, we were all socialized in one way. There was one way to think. You had a male and you had a female, and they got married.
It was limited, yeah.
They got married and they had kids, and then they figured it out. And that was the system, right? And depending on how well they could figure it out in the system is how well they and their family did. That was the system. But then we woke up, a lot of people woke up, women woke up and got a job. They realized they didn't have to be in relationships. They didn't want to be here. Some men realized I don't have to marry a woman. Some women realized I can marry a woman. You know what I mean? We got, black people got with these people got with those people. And then everybody was like, wait a minute, there is not one way to do life.
There never has been.
And there never has been. And it was a lie.
You just didn't have to get confronted with it ever.
Yes.
It didn't get any time on your TV or on your, you know, radio. So you could believe that everybody lived just like you.
Yeah. And that there was one way to live. And all we regular folk here are saying here in this world is, I want you to be happy. I want you to be fulfilled. And if you being happy and safe and fulfilled doesn't harm me, a child, or anybody on this earth, I want that for you. You know what I mean? And I can support whatever it is that is for you, you know what I mean? I'm here, I'm an ally. And that's what they really don't want in this world. They want us to fight. They want me to look at you and call you a white lady or this or that or this. We are just all global human citizens.
Fair enough. So you've been doing this kind of commentary for quite some time. And I'm wondering if you've seen some of the people that you work with change their public-facing persona over time.
There are people in this industry, particularly in comedy, who talk a really good game about equality and support and allyship, but they're not doing anything about these issues. And a lot of times they're involved in them, you know, And that is frustrating. You know, it's hard. I've tried to keep my mouth shut and let people enjoy the things they enjoy on certain things. You know, but like, I mean, about like personality differences, you know, that kind of garbage, you know, of life, because it's all high school at the end of the day, or middle school even. But, you know, there are people who, you know, they're famous, they're whatever. We've known them since Francis, especially since they were children, you know, and so we have a different perspective. And it can be frustrating when you know somebody's a total jerk and they're widely perceived as being this wonderful character. That's frustrating, you know. But they they got a persona and they're working it, and that's how it is. But I would say, it's particularly around me too, I'm really disappointed how many people just still don't seem to get it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I do think that a lot of people are checking, a lot of men, and hopefully women too, I think, are checking their creepy sexual energy and behavior. I think that, you know, like when I look at the fact that, you know, I hope that fewer women are backstage feeling like they can't say anything when somebody is an oogie manager when they're doing stand-up. Or, shoot, you know, if you're a teacher, you know what I mean? And you are in the teacher's lounge and somebody's inappropriate, or whatever space women and men are in their sexual congress, you know, potential, or, you know, exchange. You know, I just hope that, you know, people feel safer and better in their space. And that's...
People stand up for each other. Like, I'm just so sick of, like, knowing that there were people in the room and they didn't do anything.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like...
I know.
And they didn't step up. Why didn't you, you know, like, come on. So, yeah, I would say people's public personas, that the only thing I have seen in terms of people changing their point of view is maybe forgetting their point of view a little bit. Like, forgetting that for years they have said that they would never take away Roe.
Yeah.
And then they did. You know? And that's a... It's just moments like, I do think we could all use a moment of tell the truth.
So since you said you're comedians and all your friends are comedians, I have no friends who are comedians. So what is it like when you have a house party and all the guests are comedians?
Oh, my God. Okay, you can have one of two things. I have Angela and I. Doesn't even have to be a house full of comedians. Angela made me laugh so hard today that my ribs hurt. I literally busted a gut. When you have friends who are truly funny people, you know, we have walked down the street when we left a party. I still laugh when we left that party. You know what party I'm talking about, Angela?
Yeah, I know what party I'm talking about. I know what party.
It was a bunch of comedians leaving a party and somebody wasn't attractive. And when I say the lines that came out that night were just
vicious.
They were pearls.
This is the thing. I think that when we're together, what I have recognized, not because I spend some time around people who aren't comedians now more. And what I've come to realize is that we are very strange. And that the things we do are not what other people do. So when we play characters, and I don't know that that's even true for stand-up groups, but in terms of the sort of the improv community that we come from, we do bits, right? Yeah. So we'll just jump into a bit and everybody knows how to follow along and get in the bit. And other people are like, wait, are you suddenly a newscaster? I don't understand. What just happened? They don't know what's, because they don't do that. Or like we have quick references. And it's usually quick, but we also know each other really well. We've been friends forever. So we, like, so when we say things, like, we have this thing that we do all the time. And I do wonder how many people pick it up, but it's from The Matrix, where we say when something's awful, we go, not like this.
Not like this.
Not like this. Because that's not the, like, you know, this. The one when they're dying in The Matrix, the people, when they're in the real world and fake Matrix world and blah, blah, blah. And so we do it all the time. And I'm like, I always wonder how many people catch that that's what that's from, you know? So that becomes, and also things are, because we're comedians, our tolerance for pain is grossly high.
Yes.
So there are jokes that I think are wildly horrible and inappropriate and just bad. But one of the games we play as comedians is, what's the absolute worst thing you could say right now? Like that is, like, for example, I'm gonna give an example. It's not either of us. It's awful. okay? And it is objectively awful, but in a room full of comedians, it's a killer line. This guy, after a show that Francis was, I don't know if you were the director, but you were backstage for this, I think. This other guy hadn't done, it was an improv show. Parts of it didn't go well. This guy was devastated. His family had come to see him, friends, and he quit law school to do this. So he was just devastated, right? And then he's just crying and having this total breakdown. And one of the other cast members says, "Why don't you just kill yourself?" That is wrong. That is not funny. In that context,
everybody
fell out laughing. It's horrifying. It's bad. In today's world, especially, people would be like, "What?" That is the problem with hanging out with comedians, is that you can get a very bad sense of what's appropriate. And then you go out with other people and somebody has to tell you that's not an outside joke. Like we didn't say that thing, but I will tell you, we've had jokes where we're like, this is an in the car joke. This is not an out there, because we know we don't mean it. We know what our hearts are. We know what our thoughts are, our actions are. But that's the problem. I don't think you should go to comedian parties if you're not a comedian, because I don't want you hurt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then that's the other side.
It's not safe.
The other side of that coin is everybody, you know, what I learned about being a comedian and having comedian friends is those tend to be a very intelligent people, you know? And so when you've got a whole bunch of people who are trying to get on one little small patch of entertainment, you know, sometimes you'll have a lot of people vying for the spotlight, too.
Oh, yeah, that can be annoying.
And they can be on and on and on and on.
Yeah, we're not into being on, that thing, you know. But, you know, usually we go to a party and we end up just talking to each other. Well, we've had people point that out. Like, you come to this party, then you go sit with each other. I'm like, well, y'all ain't as entertaining. Yeah. Work harder. Keep our attention.
Fair enough. I think I might let that be the final word.
Okay.
Thanks for getting Unspun with me this week. Unspun is a production of me, Amanda Sturgill, and is a proud member of the MSW Media family of podcasts. Send me your thoughts and ideas about trickery in the news on Gmail at theunspunpodcast@gmail.com. I even write back. And find this episode's show notes and more information at theunspunpodcast.substack.com. Want to learn more and get smarter? Check out my book, Detecting Deception, Tools to Fight Fake News, which is available on Amazon or your favorite online bookseller. And until next time, stay sharp, everyone.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.